So today is our second and last day of our meeting, and we'll start with post-implementation review panel together with Hans, Alan, and April. We'll have about 1 hour for this session, and welcome again, and please, I'll give the floor to our team.
Thank you, Amaru. Thank you for being our charming assistant. I, in turn, will be a charming assistant, hopefully, to April, who's going to give a presentation today on post-implementation reviews. First time that we are doing it, it's going to be an extremely important part of our due process. We developed the approach that April is going to describe in close consultation with national standard setters. They were, many of you were consulted before we started doing this project, and April will be happy to tell us where we stand at this moment. April. Oops. Oh, you, me. Alan, sorry. Alan. I'm not a charming assistant.
No.
Okay.
April's going to do the heavy lifting. I'm just going to give you a brief introduction to the whole process. And so April's been working on the post-implementation review of IFRS 8 now for a long time, over a year or so. Essentially, the review itself, we do this for every major amendment or every brand new IFRS. The first one we've started with was IFRS 8. The next one is we'll talk about in a minute towards the end is IFRS 3, that's business combinations. It's something that the trustees introduced when we produced the operating segment standard. And the whole idea of this process is to try and sort of reflect on what's happened with the standard, whether it's achieved its objectives. It hasn't been without controversy either, because a lot of us, when we were developing this whole process, they questioned whether we're getting the timing right, because we look at these things about 2 to 3 years after it's mandatorily effective. That's why, for example, the IFRS 8, we're only now starting to do the review. And IFRS 3 on business combinations, so we produced that late 2007, early 2008. So only next year that we'll actually start to do the post-implementation review, because we want to see what happens in practice. We need 2 or 3 years' worth of experience. And a lot of people said to us, it's far too late. You know, by the time you're 3 years down the track, you know, all these little quirks and things, and it's a new standard, you haven't picked up things. And then a whole lot of others said, no, you're way too early, because you really need to have 4 or 5 years' worth of data to help the academics, for example, do some of the studies, to have a look at what the consequences are of a standard, whether or not investors have got better information, how they relate to prices, how behaviours have changed, all those sorts of things. In other words, people said, you've just got the timing wrong. It's too early, too late. We don't think so, and it's not being defensive, but we've got to be very careful about what the objective is here. When we first produce a standard, I'd love to think that we write perfectly and we get everything absolutely right. We don't, unfortunately. And you'll see that now and again we'll have little either narrow scope or annual improvements that address little issues in a standard. And that's what the early period's for, is for we deal with that. Wayne talked about the interpretations process yesterday. It's a very active process. We think it's an effective process. If we have little issues where there's a lack of clarity and we need to add some additional application guidance, then the early phases where we'll actually do it. We've got to be very careful, though, because whenever any new words come out, of course there's a period of trying to deal with new things. When we produced IFRS 3 on business combinations, we actually had a staff member who collected issues that were sent to us by the firms mainly, saying, you know, we're a bit worried about the wording here, and they sent us 72 essential changes we should make to the standard. We filtered those down to 10 that were actually discussed in more detail by the board. We filtered them all through our interpretations committee. I think we made 3 changes in the end through annual improvements. And personally, I think that was 2 too many. I think one of them was justifiable. And it's you know, it's easy for me to say, I think we'll find out in the post-implementation review, but I don't think we got that too wrong either. It's not as if the other 60 should have been changed. People got used to the words, and got on with life afterwards. In other words, if we're not careful, you end up just chopping and changing. I tell you what, as soon as you change the words to clarify something for somebody, somebody else says, well, I'm not quite sure what you mean, and you've got these unintended consequences. So we have an effective process of when people think diversity is about to develop, we deal with that through the interpretations and the implementation process. Okay? In terms of, you know, are we too early? Well, we get a lot of feedback as we go along, you see, from academic studies and things like that. So we just look at what information we've got, and if we're starting to get early signals or we haven't got enough information, one of the options open to us is to extend the review slightly or to say, look, let's come back and look at some aspects a little bit later on. So essentially what we're trying to do in this whole review is to say, right, 2 or 3 years down the track, we set out to change, and April's going to walk through all the IFRS 8 ones on operating segments. You know, what do we set out to do with that particular standard? Have we achieved the objective? Are there any things that didn't work out for us? You know, do we get it wrong in terms of transition? Was it much worse for transition than we anticipated? Has the information, is it better for the users, or have we actually got this wrong? They're actually struggling to work with the information. Are there some costs we've introduced into the system that we could take away? So it's a good chance to reflect on this. The other thing that was a little bit controversial, probably, was the how we do it. And partly, and by how, it's who should actually undertake the review. A lot of people told us we should get an independent group do this, and somebody suggested the firms should be employed to do this. In other words, an independent audit of the process. Trustees were very strong on this and said, no, we actually think that the ISB itself should do an internal review, obviously, with their own staff. They're not the staff who actually wrote the standard. And we've been very careful about making sure that this whole thing takes place in a very transparent way, and you'll see some of the steps we've got in a second. And so rather than actually have an independent party do that, we decided to open the, make sure it's a very transparent and very open process. And then, you know, as I say to people informally, if we try to lift up the carpet and sweep our problems underneath it, you will certainly write to us and tell us you'll lift up the carpet and sweep all those problems out again, because we can't hide behind our transparency. So we have a process that involves public consultation. Everything that all the comment letters we receive are open for the public. They're on our website. All the discussions that take place in public and the recommendations take place in public. And our due process oversight committee monitors these processes as we go along. So we've got a bit of independent oversight, as well as making sure that we've got a very rich and open process. So essentially, what we're looking at within a review is we obviously want to make sure that what we've done improves financial reporting. We pretty much know when we produce a standard what the most contentious items are. If you look at a feedback statement, I think most people will agree we've probably identified the big issues. Sometimes we don't get it all. So we're interested in looking at things that we anticipated might be controversial, and also things that, since it's been produced, have emerged as being more controversial. And that can be unexpected costs, difficulties in implementation, loss of information, all sorts of things like that. So it is a very open process. Now, what April's going to describe to you is the steps we took for IFRS 8, but very generally, the first thing we do is our staff get together and sit down and plan the whole scope of this review. And by planning the scope, essentially we're working out what is it we want to ask you guys when we put out a request for information. And so April, for example, will contact the firms, the accounting firms. There's a lot of involvement with the standard setters themselves in terms of talking to standard setters about experiences they've had in their jurisdiction. And usually it's pretty easy to see where the main tensions are, what seems to be working well, and so on. So we paint an initial picture of how well we think a standard's gone. We then use that to put together a public request for information. And that's what's out now, for example, for IFRS 8. Again, April will go through and talk through some of the details in that particular one. That's our way of getting feedback. And it's as well as identifying what we think are the main messages we're hearing, we clearly have a very open process as well. We ask for any other issues. And so people write that, send back comment letters. We undertake a review of those in public. And that's part of Phase B. But at the same time, we also do an academic review. And in this particular case, we had an academic who looked at a whole lot of material on IFRS 8. Again, April will go a little bit more detail. But we're interested to see an independent perspective of what's actually happened in practice as well. So we have these two lots of threads going on. One is we have the request for information, we have the academic review, and another thing that happens is we then go and do some interviews and some surveys, talking to analysts and other people like that. So all this information comes together, feeds into phase B, where the board, in open meeting, considers all of the reports and the analysis from the staff and then presents findings. Now, the one question people ask is, well, what are you going to do generally with a feedback with this whole process? Does this mean that you're going to review it and then recommend changes to the standard? Well, the answer is not necessarily. What should happen is whatever we find has to feed into our general process, in that we spoke yesterday about the agenda consultation. Now, we had something like 30 projects we looked at that are competing for resources. Just because you have a post-implementation review doesn't mean a change to IFRS 8 or a change to IFRS 3 should get priority over something like agriculture, discount rates or anything like that. It's going to have to feed back in, and we're going to have to assess whether or not it's how important it is for it in terms of resources. It might be that we discover, as I alluded to a minute ago, that the transaction costs were much, much greater than we anticipated, particularly on transition. It's a bit late to go and change that now, but that will help us learn for the next time. So some of this might be about learning about what we got right and what we got wrong in terms of anticipating things. So we will end up with the staff will make recommendations for what actions the board should actually take, and that completes our process, and we then produce this final public report. So that's the very general idea that we put together. You know, I've raced through that in about 6 or 7 minutes. I think what April will now do is to walk through the IFRS 8 process, and you'll see how these pieces are fitted together for a particular standard.
Before I give the floor to April, just one short comment on my side. We were, of course, happy that our trustees had enough confidence in our independence that we can do these post-implementation reviews ourselves. We are very happy to have trustees and not mistrustees. But also, given the scarcity of expertise in accounting standards, et cetera, setting, where would you find it to do such an implementation review? We have all the staff that you need, so we feel perfectly capable and sufficiently self-critical to do this job well. April.
Thanks, Hans. I'll stand to one side of the podium so that I can see you and you can see me. The previous standard was one that was very defined in how you identify your segments. You had a primary and a secondary basis of segmentation. One was either your operations by geography or the products and services that you provide to the customers, and you had more prescribed disclosure for the primary segment and less prescribed disclosure for the secondary segment. And all of the line items that were disclosed for those segments were measured on an IFRS basis. So the operating segment note, prepared in accordance with IAS 14, agrees directly with the financial statements. IFRS 8 took quite a different view. IFRS 8 is based on the business as it's managed internally. And so the segments are identified on the basis of the information that's used to make an assessment of the operations and also to allocate resources. And similarly, the line items are the line items that are regularly reported to the person who makes those decisions, and they're all measured in accordance with the internal reporting requirements. Now, because of that, IFRS 8 segment information will need to be reconciled with the financial statements. And that's because there may be some segments which are not included within the operating segment information. For example, if you've got HQ cost centers, the definition of the line items may be different. So, for example, a number of entities will disclose EBITDA and we'll need to reconcile that. Or the measurement basis may be different. So the IFRS 8 operating segment note will be reconciled to the financial statements. Now, looking at the differences between IAS 14 and IFRS 8 highlights the decisions that the board made when they were developing IFRS 8, and that's that you would identify your segments based on how you were managing your business from the management perspective. You disclose information about those segments based on the information that went to the people making decisions about those segments, and then you'd measure those reported line items on the basis that you did for your own internal reporting. So, as Alan said, the RFI, the Request for Information, is our basis for our public consultation. And during the development of the questions that were going to go into the RFI, we used a list of issues that had been identified to make sure that the questions would be worded in such an open way that we'd get as much information as possible and bring as many issues as possible to light. And many of you in this room were involved in actually developing that list of issues with us. The first question we ask in the request for information is information about the respondent, because operating segment information is of interest in all jurisdictions, whether you're a current user of IFRSs or whether you're somewhere on the path to adopting IFRSs. And so that information about the respondent will better allow us to understand the answers to the subsequent questions in the context of that respondent's experience. We'll know what they're comparing IFRS 8 with and what change they're actually commenting on. The other questions then allow us to assess the effect. Questions 2, 3, and 4 deal with the really fundamental decisions that were made in developing the standard. That's the segmentation based on management perspective, measurement based on internal reporting, and reporting only those line items that are used by the decision maker. We're also asking a question about the effect of the disclosure on the role of the respondent, whether it's a preparer of accounts, an investor, a regulator, or a fellow standard setter. And we're also then asking the respondent to tell us what effect implementing IFRS 8 had on them. Now, we are actually supplementing this with a great deal of outreach. As Alan said earlier, we're using the request for information as our basic means of gathering the information, and that's a very transparent, very public process. And actually, we're finding it quite difficult to engage with people in that route. It's been out for comment for 3.5 months. We've had 2 comment letters so far. We do have another 3 weeks to go, and I hope as many of you as possible in this room will send us a comment letter, either individually or through your regional representative. But I think there may be a couple of reasons why we're not getting this response. One is, I think, simply some people are just very busy, and they're in overload, and they can't cope with this. It may also be that potential respondents don't find looking back all that interesting. It may not be sexy enough for them to sort of get involved. Or it could be that this is really a very different process from our normal one. Normally, when we're asking people to comment, we're asking them to comment on a proposal for a future standard, asking them to speculate about what might happen in the future if an exposure draft became a standard. I think for some respondents, there's a feeling that what we're actually doing when we're looking backwards at what they've been doing in practice in the last 3 years is asking them to confess what they've got wrong, asking them to confess, you know, what mistakes they think they may have made in their reporting, where they may have misinterpreted things. And so we're very much taking the view that we're going out and talking, as well as doing the RFI, talking confidentially to people to get as much information as we can about that. Now, just to remind you very briefly about the effect of the management perspective, one of the benefits was that it would achieve convergence with the US, and the two standards are now virtually identical, so that's been achieved at a reasonable cost. It was thought that the management eyes perspective would allow people to better understand the business. The operating segment information would be reflected in the management commentary, which would add more depth to that understanding. And certainly, we find that where the management commentary agrees with the operating segment note, that has cross-validated both of those sets of information. And most importantly, the idea was that the management perspective would allow investors and other users of the financial statements to really understand how management were managing that business and what risks they were managing. Now, at the time of issuing IFRS 8, there were some contentious issues. The board were aware of some concerns, and those principally came from the comment letters at the time. There was some concern that you'd get inconsistent segments between entities. There was a concern that if an entity reorganized internally frequently, you'd lose your trend information, because every time they reorganized, they'd restate one comparative, but you wouldn't have 3 or 4 years of information. A lot of concern that there wouldn't be geographical analyses now available, and also that the non-IFRS measures wouldn't be understood and wouldn't be reliable. So we're going to ask you to have two discussions today. The first one is on how the basis of segmentation has affected financial reporting in your jurisdiction, and then the second one is about implementation issues that have arisen with you. So on the question two, in the request for information, ask for information about the effect of the decisions to use the management perspective. Did that allow investors to better understand future results and cash flow? What effect has it had on regulators and enforcement in your area? Now, one concern that people have had is that it would actually reduce the comparability between entities. Has that actually happened compared with IAS 14? One view is that because entities are always structured differently, whenever you compare the different operating segments of two entities, they're always going to be different no matter what basis you do it on, because the constituents of that business are going to be different. They're going to produce different products. They're going to be in different geographies. So it's always going to be very difficult to compare those two entities. So we'd like to know what happened when what happened in your area. If I could just ask you, if we just discuss this for 5 or 10 minutes, and ask you to leave the practical implementation issues like identifying the segments and the chief operating decision maker to the second question, which is about implementation. If I could just ask you now if you've got any comments you'd like to share on what the effect of the basis of segmentation was in your jurisdiction.
Who wants to make a contribution? Do you have a specific question? Yes? Bileng?
Thank you, Hans. April, not to worry, we will send in our comment letters. Pursuant to your comment that you only received 2 letters so far. Okay. What we understand from our constituents, with this IFRS 8, there's fewer line items, fewer disclosure line items, because under IAS 14, I think you have, very prescriptive line items, so fewer line items. And I think as to the comparability, there is another point of view that it is important. Although comparability is important, but it's also very important to understand from the management's perspective how they manage their resources. So this reporting through the eyes of management is actually quite a good concept.
Is that also, I'm sure that preparers love these particular aspects of this standard, but is this also what you find among your users? Or haven't you heard them about that?
I think split view, some regulators feel this may be important to understand from the management's perspective. So it's really split views.
Can I just say to that, that talking to investors, one thing that we have found is that when the management commentary, the operating segment note, and the presentations to investors agree, that gives investors a lot of comfort because they feel that the management commentary has been audited because it agrees with the audited financial statements. In some jurisdictions, there does seem to be a mistrust between investors and preparers. There are some investors who think, are we really sure that this is the real basis that they're managing on? Which is not something that I've particularly noticed before, but that we get those comments from 1 or 2 jurisdictions.
Those are certainly comments that I have heard in conversation with the investor community. But perhaps other people. Yes, Atsu.
Thank you, Hans and Aran and April. In Japan, as I mentioned yesterday, some of the companies have already voluntarily adopted IFRS, so that they are applying IFRS 8. And also, even under the Japanese GAAP for segment reporting is very similar to IFRS 8 because we have substantially converged our standard with IFRS 8, so that this post-implementation review is a very interested subject in Japan as well, so that we have involved in developing your questionnaire and so on. In general, in Japan, financial preparers and auditors are, in general, very satisfied with IFRS 8. However, some concerns are coming from a user of a financial, statement. This basis for segmentation, some of users are saying reporting segment, how to determine the, reporting segment, that methodology or criteria are not really so much detailed or sophisticated as expected by users. So that this point may be, given comment from user side. And also, with respect to information to be disclosed under this standard, some users are not happy with some of excluded information compared from a previous standard, IS 14. Such as like sales outside Japan. This is a very important indicator for measuring a company's global activities. So users are not really happy with excluding this information. They have similar some other concerns such as CODM. This may be the next discussion point, but really, there are some divergences or different, decision making. Who should be, or how should make a decision? Who is the CODM? There are diversities in practice. Those are, concerns expressed so far by primarily, users of financial information.
Does the is the user community capable of exerting pressure on preparers to include that information that they want, which they, the preparers could do it if they wanted. Have you seen instances of that happening?
Or I think users, I think may have already expressed their concern. Those information should be disclosed, but in general, preparers want to maximize, what should be disclosed unless those are required by the standard. That is, some sort of problems.
So just one little quick thing. You made an interesting comment in there. You talked about how IFRS 8 had excluded disclosures. And it's fascinating when we think about disclosure overload because we were, I think that the probably the way I would describe it is AS 14 was more prescriptive, and it's not that we prevent anybody from disclosing information, but it's less prescriptive than IFRS 8. And it's interesting because in many ways we're criticised for being too prescriptive in our disclosure standards anyway, and this is a case where we're less prescriptive, and this that you're quite right. The feedback we're hearing is that because we're less prescriptive, there's less detail in terms of down the segments, fewer lines being reported.
Gordon?
In Canada, we jointly developed our segment reporting issue along with the U.S. that generated FASB 131, and we've been reporting for in excess of 10 years on essentially the same basis as IFRS 8. It has ended up being in the top two or three issues that our securities regulators are perpetually asking preparers to justify their disclosures. And the number one item inside of comment letters that come from the securities regulators is the basis for aggregating segments. And despite the best part of, I guess, actually 15 years of experience, issuers continue to assert the competitive harm argument about actually complying with the standard and giving a more disaggregated presentation. And talk about distrust between users and preparers. There's a great source of distrust between the regulators and preparers, because the regulators have been known to actually ask preparers to submit the documents the CODM gets, and they will second guess whether they have complied. The other newer issue that in Canada the regulators are running into and companies are running into is just the growth in management information systems, where the CODM can literally look at any part of the company at any time just by calling up different screens. So it's much more difficult for the company to identify, auditors to audit, and the regulators to oversee the identification of segments, because of the way a lot of these systems are organized, matrix organizations, et cetera. It's very difficult to identify what the segments are. But aggregation and identifying the segments is the number one issue that has been identified.
Gordon, I didn't quite understand what made that more complex. Are the organizations getting more complex?
It was just that the CODM is getting information literally every hour. It's not paper based anymore.
Yeah.
The whole standard is based on a paper based assumption that pieces of paper come in at the end of the month to the CODM. That is not what happens today. They look up stuff every minute, every hour, on any different combination of ways to look at the organization.
So we should not have quarterly reporting, but reporting by the minute.
Yeah. The other feedback, we have a user advisory council, and we've also sponsored other presentations. The perpetual number one complaint that our users have is the lack of sufficient disaggregation of the companies in Canada. Most of them, for a complex company, believe that their analysis is what they call the sum of the parts. And the only way they can do sum of the parts is that they get accurate segmented information, and they perpetually complain that the segments are too aggregated, and in many cases that there are too many, quote, reorganizations, end quote, and there's no consistency of the definition of what the segments are from period to period.
Now, if these frustrations are so high, why do we get so little response?
Come to Canada and visit our User Advisor Council.
I will, Gordon, I promised. Simon, and then I would like to hear from Tom what the experience is in the United States.
We had a round table in Hong Kong at the end of September, and Michael Stewart from the ISB joined us for that. So over the course of 2 or 3 hours, we had quite a discussion with our preparers and users and auditors and so forth, regulators and academics. I think one of the key messages that came out of that roundtable, and personally it was a little bit of a surprise, but the preparer group that we had to a T said that they didn't really modify their reporting under IFRS 8 at all, because they were able to, if you like, retrofit what they had put into place by way of systems and internal reporting, which had been previously in compliance with IFRS 14, and they basically just continued with what essentially was an IS 14 model, retrofitted into IFRS 8 requirements.
Hmm. Interesting. Tom, you in the United States are doing your own review. Can you tell us a little bit?
Well,
we're
in the midst of a review of the same standard, yep. but as you know, the board's not involved with our review. The foundation is, and there's a pretty significant wall between those two activities. So we've not heard the outcome of our review yet. However, when we were doing the financial statement presentation projects jointly in the United States, there was much view by many users, and users never talk in one voice, but by many users, that some of the most significant gains to be had in the financial statement presentation project was to do better job in segment reporting. And they've expressed frustration that the segments weren't disaggregated far enough, and that the information, when provided, consistent with management view, didn't aggregate back up to the financial statements itself, because only what might be communicated to management might be a very small subset of that information, and then a lot of items not allocated being thrown in another column, and they found that to be a source of frustration, a source of distrust of management, frustration about changing segments but far too few segments, and an inability to be able to roll it up to the financial statements is a major problem. So the management eye's view is something that they question, the user side of things. But as we both experienced, the preparers very much would like a management eye view to this particular reporting, in part for proprietary reasons, in part because in an internal view, they can decide how to really, how much they're going to show in the segments.
Yeah, I suppose that the investors would have nothing against seeing the management's view, but they're not always sure that they get the complete picture.
And so some of the feedback we received was, show the management's view, but then fill it out. And have it disaggregated consistently with further breakdown, aggregating up to the statements. And we'd like to know how management thinks about things, but make it complete.
Okay. April.
Thanks, Hans. The next question we'd like to ask you is about the effect of the implementation in your jurisdiction. When the standard was developed, the board thought that implementation would be much easier for preparers, because we would just be reporting what already existed in internal reporting systems. And as Simon said earlier, in a number of jurisdictions, we found that people didn't actually change. The big corporates had so geared up their internal monthly reporting into what was an IAS 14 format that they continued doing that, and that's actually what they were using after IFRS 8 was implemented. It does vary a lot by jurisdiction and by the size of the entity. There were some practical issues that were identified. One was that some people have wondered whether their internal reporting was actually good enough to use for financial reporting, and they did incur costs when they improved the controls within their financial reporting system. There were a couple of particular areas which have caused concern. One is the identification of the chief operating decision maker, who's defined as a function in the standard, who makes decisions about assessing the operations and about allocating resources. The other area that comes up in these discussions quite often is the aggregation principles. You identify your operating segments, and then you aggregate them into reporting segments on a number of sort of threshold basis. Anything which has got revenues of greater than 10% would be a reporting segment. You need to have your reporting segments adding up to be at least 75% of the segmentation you disclose. So that's the sort of implementation experience and questions we've had. Both of those questions, by the way, were referred to the IFRS Interpretations Committee. Another concern that some people raised, and I know which some of the board members had, was the commercial effect on smaller listed entities or smaller entities reporting under IFRS 8. If you're in a very large, very diverse group or conglomerate, you obviously have much less detail about what are the constituents of each of your operating segments. Whereas if you're a smaller entity with fewer sort of lines of business or fewer operating segments, those operating segments are going to be much more exposed than your competitors. So if I could just ask you to discuss for 10 or 15 minutes what the effect of implementation was in your jurisdiction, please.
Sue.
My name's not Sue, but I still speak for South Africa.
A standard setter called Sue.
I think one of the particular issues that has come up is the identification of the CODM. And I suspect that in most cases it's taken more to be the level of the non-executive director rather than the idea of management, who manage it on a day-to-day basis. And I think as a result of that, if we look at the impact, is that many companies are quite comfortable with the level of disclosures. By taking it to the level of the non-executive, they can give fewer segments than if it was being used at a lower level of management, who are effectively the CEO, CFO, who are managing it on a day-to-day basis. And I think as a result of that, you find the attitudes towards the disclosures, while companies themselves might be quite happy, the analysts are probably not quite as happy, and I think the auditors probably take a bit of a cynical view on the disclosures.
Thank you. Other experiences. We already heard from Hong Kong that nothing really changed over there. And we heard some more about the United States. I think we can move on to it.
Okay. I'm just here. What I'll do is I'll just wrap up with a few comments that we've heard, and in doing so, actually respond to a couple of things that have been said this morning as well, because they're consistent messages we're hearing. I think one of the challenging things for us is that we often hear people, and particularly investors, and we met on Wednesday. We had a full day meeting with our Capital Markets Advisory Committee, and we ask the same question of the analysts, and you hear quite often they say, you know, there's a disconnect between, you know, as April said, perhaps the management commentary or what we hear at the investor calls or the investor meetings, for example, or meetings with analysts, and what we see in the segment reporting, and that they are uncomfortable with that. And they say, therefore, it's a failing in IFRS 8. And, of course, the question we're really interested in as well is, how does that compare with IAS 14, because we've changed from one standard to another, and it's very easy to take in absolute terms IFRS 8 and conclude that the standard is failing. Well, it may be that it was worse before, because essentially IAS 8 was telling you, you know, you've got geographical and industry segments, and that may be nothing at all to do with the way management actually ran their business. So they may have described to you in management commentary the way they ran it, and then we've got a disconnect before. And we don't know. I'm not saying that's the case, but we have to be very careful and cautious in the way we analyse, because we're comparing with the old standard that we replaced. The other thing, the analysts are also very open too about, you know, they'd love to have consistency, but consistency in their own minds as well. And I think they're fairly honest with that as well. You know, we had an example was given to us on Wednesday where somebody said they was involved in an analyst call, and I think the company had reported two or three segments. But in the analyst call, they talked about 10 different types of categories. But sometimes, I suspect anyway, and I think generally suspect, what the company's doing is responding to the analyst's request for particular information. It might not be the way the companies actually manage their products, but take something like, you know, telecommunications, and because it's easy when we talk about quite often. If the analysts want to know handset sales, sales from other types of products and so on, they'll ask for that detailed information. Now, that may not be the way that every company actually manages their products. They may think of them in different ways, but they actually want handset information. They want the number of the churn rates and all sorts of things like that. So they'll actually ask for it. So there can be a disconnect between the conversations they have and the information we see in the financial statements. And we have to ask whether or not, you know, what's the cause of that? In other words, are the general purpose financial statements meeting their needs or not? You know, where's the tension? One of the analysts actually made the comment, you know, perhaps if they really are managing it the way they say, then they're not very good. And it's actually helpful to know that if that's the way they're managing it, then they're not actually understanding their own risks themselves. So this is actually particularly challenging. I always think in some ways it's a shame IFRS 8 or operating segments is our first post-implementation review, because this is such, you know, as Tom said, it's probably the most significant piece, you know, in a financial statement presentation project. I actually think that a lot of users would argue that instead of an income statement, the segment income statement should be the primary statement, because it tells you what's going on in a business. The early analysis is that I think there's a concern about loss of geographical information more than anything else. And that there's a loss of a little bit of loss of that. preliminary results suggest that there are actually fewer single-segment companies. The academic research has shown empirically that we're actually getting more segmentation. So to think of it in very simple terms, probably more columns than we had before, on average. What we're not getting, though, is the same depth of analysis in terms of go down the column. We're not getting as much detail in terms of number of lines. And I think, you know, some people have suggested, April, for example, that there's a lack of consistency about what lines they're getting. Because we're more prescriptive in IS8, we're actually now getting management's little spin on that, in a sense. And one of the cynical ones that April's provided to me says some investors suggest that the definition of operating result is profit before expenses. In other words, people are being a little bit selective about what they put into their operating line. And that, so people then question about comparability. But, you know, flip that over the other side, we get accused of having these lines with no flexibility, and analysts want EBIT and EBITDA and these other things. We're actually starting to see EBIT and EBITDA actually appear in the segment reporting. So it's actually, it seems to be that's what people have been asking for, and that's what they're getting in some ways. But it's just that less detail. So I think geography and the lack of depth or detail are probably the things that people are concerned about. The comparability issue is so challenging because, you know, we've mentioned it, a couple of people mentioned it here. How do you compare? Because you can actually have two industries, you know, like even airlines, for example. You know, I've seen under the old segment reporting when they were doing geographies, basically, I know airline where I came from, you know, it said basically it did international travel, and that was it. So international's a fairly big segment. And I would have thought there'd be different risks in different markets, but that's what they did under the old standard. And so, and it's also difficult if people are managing their businesses in a particular way, and let's assume for a moment that the way they're managing and presenting them are the same, then just the whole idea of the accounting standard is not to force people to manage them in the same way. We want to understand it is comparable. If they're managing a different way, then analysts should understand that process as well. And so financial reporting is not about forcing exactly the same presentation. That doesn't reflect what's happening underneath. But I think the point that April's probably raised is some people are a little bit cynical that what's happening in terms of the way they're managing, the chief operating decision makers, actually information they're getting. They're cynical that that's exactly what they are getting, that we're seeing outside. And the lack of change from
so
the old...
Where's the cynicism?
The users in particular. Yeah. And it's the lack of change is probably one of those signals, because they say, because you're supposed to report the numbers the chief operating decision maker receive, and yet the IFRS numbers haven't changed. So do they really get the IFRS numbers? And people are cynical that there's a disconnect there. So, you know, I think we will find... I'm not too worried about the lack of comment letters so far, because I think about 98% of them come in within the last 2 hours before our cutoff. That's our history. So I think some will come in, but it's going to be really fascinating to see information about what people actually think about this.
The more I think about it, Alan, it is truly very interesting, this, because this seems to be a sort of a free enterprise zone within accounting. Where you have a high degree of liberty in terms of disclosures. Of course, the pressure on us to release the pressure on disclosures is huge. So it's very interesting to see what do you get if you do that? What do you sacrifice? And are the people who we do our work for, are they happy with it? So I do hope that we will get some more information from our constituents.
I was just going to say one other message that we have also received is about the reconciliations of the operating segment to the financial statements. In some cases, that is a compliance issue. IFRS 8 is quite clear that you must reconcile the two, and in some cases, that's not being done. But there is concern by some people that there's just too much in the reconciling items. There have been some examples of very large percentages of the results being in an other column or not explained, and that there's not enough granularity of the reconciliations themselves to understand what they mean.
a very frequent comment from investors is that they'd like to see that reconciliation analyzed out segment by segment so they know where the risks occur and where they have to concentrate on.
Well, in several countries in Latin America, we have a problem also that this year and last year is a year when there were changes to implementing full IFRS. So for many entities, the problems of implementing IFRS 8 are obscured due to the problems of implementing all the IFRSs. So for certain enterprises, it will be difficult to distinguish which were the specific problems of IFRS 8 from the problems of all IFRSs.
This time, truly, Sue? Okay.
Truly,
Sue. I don't want to offend anybody anymore.
Truly, Sue, this time. Just to add on from South Africa, and you will get comment letters from us too, is just very interesting, such mixed views that we've had from preparers and users. Preparers, some of them have made a significant change and being able to do what they want is great, and others just saying, well, no, nothing changed. Their systems are there, very much what we've heard before, and continuing to provide that information. And then from their side and then the user side, users saying, well, yes, it's in theory very nice to get how management are going to be managing their business, that skeptical nature of that. But essentially, I think we find probably in our jurisdiction and everywhere else too that users are lazy. So, and preparers have been giving them information. So the analyst-type booklets-type information that is asked for, which is probably more volumetric, more metrics type and related to how they run their organization, is the kinds of things that they then ask for. That's the kind of things that they're getting. And there seems to be a disconnect so far that we've seen that the preparers are not putting that information in their segment reports. So that is not coming through there. So users are not, some of them are saying they're not even looking at that because it's easier just to get the information through their analyst presentation, analyst booklets, or whatever they're getting. So definitely mixed views.
That's an interesting comment.
Yeah, it shows how hard it's going to be, I think, for us, because we're going to get mixed views. I actually think it's very helpful timing-wise for this process as well, because I think it's going to feed very nicely into our conceptual framework, the disclosure package as well, because, you know, I mentioned yesterday that there's some really good work was done in financial statement presentation, and we're going to have to look at that again, I think, as part of disclosure and presentation, and we might learn something from this feedback and feed that back into it. So this is not necessarily going to be us reacting to IFRS 8, but seeing if we, you know, more generally how it relates to what people want to the financial statements to tell us.
I mean, sorry.
What Sue just described, the mechanism could be that investors know that the segment reporting has lost its rigor and comparability, so why don't we look at the numbers they fabricate, makes especially for us anyway, why don't we go straight to that instead of wasting our time on segment reporting? Is that more or less what you describe?
That is, that they're saying that they're getting that information. And let's not forget that there's integrated reporting as well that's sort of taking on a new lease and getting information from there. That's sort of summarized financial information. So it's lots of information that in users will look at, and probably the easiest for them, whatever they feel that is.
Okay, I think we're about to head for the coffee break, Amaru. Yes?
I think we just maybe finish comment on the timeline that for this project.
Yes, almost forgot about that, didn't we? The nature of the process. We've got the wrapping up in a couple of weeks in terms of getting comments back. That means April then has got a very busy time doing summary of all the comments received. All the comment letters will be up on our website. And then we'll take papers back to the board after that, early next year, I think it is. And we've also, we had an interim analysis, academic analysis that Antarka put together for us. She's following that up so that early next year, again, we'll have that updated. You know, we had a look at some preliminary studies, even things like looking at relating it to prices and things like bid-ask spreads and ALICE forecasts, because they're good proxies for information asymmetry. And the initial results didn't indicate any significant change from the old IS-14. So at least the comfort is, I'm not saying that it's too early to get definitive evidence in there, but I didn't see any red flags flying just yet anyway. So we're going to be updating that academic research, and then everything gets presented to the board, and then we'll, early next year, and then we'll wrap up with our recommendations, and we'll also take that through to our trustees. The idea of this is we've also slowed down IFRS 3, and I'll mention that very briefly, and that's business combinations. We were due to start that probably about this year, but we thought it was better to actually just put it back 6 months or so to see how this process evolves, and make sure that the way we're putting our request information together, the way we're collecting information, is actually a productive way to do that. But we expect to start. We've actually done some preliminary thinking about the scope, and boy, it's fascinating. Everybody wants to look at goodwill. They want to look at goodwill amortization. They want to look. It's so many things that are coming up in business combinations. So we'll start that early next year, and that'll be our second major one. But can I also just say, probably more than a half of April, the help we've had from standard setters has been tremendous, in that we had conference calls much earlier on the process. They've been really helpful in setting up, you know, Simon said, for Hong Kong and others. We've had sessions talking to people that they've arranged for us, plus the standard, you were standard setters actually participating on calls with us to try and help us scope out the request information. And it's very important. That's what this network is all about, is making sure that we don't sit in isolation at Cannon Street trying to sort of peer out the window to see what a new standard's effects are likely to be. We need your help and input, because things can be slightly different in different jurisdictions, the way different industries and so on. So it's very much appreciated.
Okay, thank you very much, Alan, Hans, and April, for this panel. This is our last plenary session in this very same room. We'll now, after tea, coffee break, you are heading to this breakout sessions. You have a handout on your table indicating that there are two, at least, that are related to this one. As Alan said, the disclosure framework and also the conceptual framework, that two sessions that will you have the opportunity today. Just to confirm, all the rooms are in this floor, starting at 10:30 sharp, so coffee and tea will be served. Lunch will be at 12:30 in the very same room as yesterday, and at 1:30 p.m. you start back on the sessions. I would just take this opportunity to thank the people who are behind us organizing this, particularly Gloria, Janet and Carol, the ladies that happily help us during all the time, and also Guillermo and Mike under the education initiative in the ISB. We hope to meet you again next year in September. Please save the dates, 23-24 September in London. And there are one additional remark I'd like to make. You know, most of you or some of you are involved with the IFAS, so they had the meeting this week in Zurich. Next meeting will be in April in Brazil. And we are taking the opportunity to have the IFAS happening in Brazil, in São Paulo, to run our IFAS conference in São Paulo as well. So in the week starting on the 15th of April next year, we'll have about 1 week of IFAS activities in Latin America. São Paulo is the place only because we take the advantage of having the IFAS meeting over there. So all of you are invited to come to Brazil, participate in the IFAS if you are within the group, but also participate in our conference. I think in April we'll have even more interesting aspects to discuss with you. And on behalf of the ISB, I thank you very, very much for coming. Take your time to come to London, and not only being here, but also being for your active participation and collaboration during these 2 days. So it's not the end. You have lots of breakout sessions, many interesting sessions. Some are exploring a little bit further issues that were presented yesterday, and we hope you enjoy your time in London and take advantage of these 2 days here. Again, thank you very much. Have a good Christmas after that.